Welcome back to the film experience. This is our Cannes follow-up. Nick and I did a little preview, and for today we have special guest Guy Lodge.
Hello.
Who was actually in Cannes, so rather than Nick and I just drooling on the names, we have, you know, an eyewitness to the event. Guy, what did you think of the... How are you feeling about the Palme d'Or?
Well, I was quite a foggy eyewitness at this point. I'm so tired, I can't even quite remember. I think I'm still in Cannes, but I'm not sure. But the Palme d'Or was one that I half saw coming with a fair bit of dread, because I did not get on with the very appropriately titled Winter Sleep at all. Mm-hmm. I usually run pretty hot and cold with Nuri Bilge Ceylan's work. I really love Distant and really hate Climates, and you know, Three Monkeys was pretty good, and Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, once I kind of saw it the second time, grew on me. But this one, maybe it will grow on me, but I would be very, very surprised, because I just thought it was his most sort of obtuse and unrevealing kind of work. And I think it's a work that's quite hostile to its audience. It's 3 hours and 16 minutes of very kind of dense, but at the same time very on-the-nose kind of conversation about social and political tensions and intellectual hypotheses that they then sort of rag on about for sort of 4 to 5 minutes at a time. It's of all interiors, so you don't even get those lovely kind of Anatolian sort of steppe landscapes that, you know, made the last one so kind of compelling.
So, but he's one of those filmmakers, like the Dardenne brothers, for example, who for once didn't win anything, but where you can, it's a safe bet he's going to win something when he goes.
Yeah, exactly. And it was, I mean, people often don't realize that Cannes can be a bit like the Oscars. You can be overdue for the Palme d'Or. And so, you know, he's won the Grand Prix, the runner-up prize, twice. He's won Best Director once before. So at that point, there's nowhere really you can go but to win the Palme d'Or. So that's why he entered the festival as the front runner. Basically, everyone kind of said, well, the film just has to basically deliver, and it's his for the taking. And that turned out to be the case. It screened pretty early on at the festival in what was like the hottest ticket of the entire festival, because it was the only one where they combined the press screening and the public premiere. So, you know, even like Manola Dargis was scrambling for a place and almost getting shut out, and it was bedlam, really. I think it's the only time people will be fighting for tickets to see a 196-minute Nuri Bilge Ceylan film. But
it might be the only time they have a chance.
Yeah, exactly. It's the joy of Cannes.
And, but, so in a way, like, of course, with the overdue thing and the Oscar comparison, in a way that's, we end up with the same problems with, you know, you might win for your lesser work.
Exactly.
If it becomes a momentum situation.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say there are a lot of critics who think Winter Sleep is extraordinary. So, you know, and are very, very happy with that win. So I cannot speak for them. But to me, it felt like maybe the jury just generally responded to this one in isolation. But yeah, it felt like a sort of a marking time award.
And do you think that's because there wasn't a clear favorite? Because it seemed like every day, at least from my perspective here in New York, reading about it, it seemed like every day there was a new, oh, this one's going to win.
Yeah.
So it was very divided.
There wasn't like, you know, I thought in previous years I've been to Cannes, you can feel the sort of town kind of pulling eventually for one film. Like last year when Blue is the Warmest Color premiered, that just... there was such a kind of overwhelming wave of sentiment for that. You could just feel it moving in that direction. And similarly with Amour the year before. And this year it was, I think, support was much more scattered between, you know, about 5 or 6 films that all had fairly kind of deep pockets of support, but some all in opposition to each other. I thought on the last day, the second last day, Andrzej Zbiagintsev's Leviathan seemed to come the closest, I thought, to becoming a buzz film. It sort of, there was a lot of advanced chatter about it because they'd sort of screened it to select critics beforehand. It had the kind of political thing going for it. It's a terrific film, so it got this warm wave of applause. And I thought it could be the kind of the last minute one that just sneaks in and takes it, but it wasn't quite to be.
I was perplexed that they screened it so late. I mean, it was the second to last one to bow, right? Which is usually not when you program the things that they're thinking about as being heavily in contention.
Yeah, I mean, they did that a bit this year. I mean, Xavier Dolan was very unhappy with what he saw as his late slot in the programming. But then we must remember that The Class won in 2008, and that was the very last film screened in competition.
Yeah.
It's not always necessarily a diss to be at the end. It seems
a strange... Xavier Dolan has waited a long time for this. I mean, he's practically eight.
Yeah, exactly. And he
I was going to say, is he ever happy about anything? You always hear that he's, you know, put out by something.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know that getting just the jury prize and having to share it with some old man is just tearing him up inside.
So, now, as I understand it, you are not completely sold on Mommy.
No. I mean, I like a lot of things about it. I don't like Xavier Dolan as an individual. He seems quite hard to take, but I think he's a really exciting filmmaker. And his last one, Tom at the Farm, was the one that really kind of sold me on him. I was like, this is the real deal. It's such a terrific film. It's so
yeah, I love that. I love that one.
And this, to me, felt like, don't tell Sasha Stone this, but it felt like a step back to kind of ostentatious indulgence of Lawrence Anyways and Heartbeats, which is kind of fun in itself, but I thought he was moving forward with kind of fine-tuning his aesthetic, and this is more of his kind of usual grab bag of influences, and it's fun to watch, but it just felt less kind of confident and less substantial to me. But it's a really interesting film and a really touching one, and it's actressy to the max. I mean, the Anne Duvall and Suzanne Clément are both going at it. Anne Duvall particularly, she's kind of terrific, but it's a performance that starts kind of amped up at 11 and doesn't really go down from there.
Well, speaking of starting from 11, I'm hearing we have to discuss Julianne Moore since it's the film experience. I'm hearing that performance is very, very big too. The people who hate it, you know, seem to say the same things about it as the people who love it.
Yeah.
So it's a little confusing from the outside.
Yeah, I love that performance. I'm not entirely sold on the film, but I think she really delivers, and it didn't surprise me that Jane Campion's jury would have kind of really gone in for that film, because it's so for that performance, it's such a kind of smart, concept-y performance, but also just really kind of sexy and fun. She plays a kind of, it's a performance that actually works very well in parallel to what Juliette Binoche is doing in Clouds of Sils Maria. They're both playing actressy versions of themselves.
Yeah, I was shocked to read, like, when I was writing, like, little things about them, that you can almost synopsize them in the exact same way.
Yeah, both actresses sort of pursuing roles in remakes of projects that, in Julianne Moore's case, it's the project that made her mother. In Binoche's case, it's the project that made her. But yeah, those films would play very well kind of as a double bill.
Well, and then their co-lead is their assistant in both cases, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And Julianne Moore is just playing the kind of Hollywood bitch from hell, and she's having a blast doing it. But she's also, it's full of kind of Julianne Moore touches of these kind of facial reactions to, I'm not going to spoil things, but there's a great bit where she basically receives some news that's very bad for someone else and very good for her. And the way you kind of watch her face kind of process these two conflicted sort of reactions and try and keep her excitement down, it's great work. So it's both large in its gestures and small in its details in kind of the way that she can be when she's at her best.
Oh, good. Now I'm even more excited.
And she gets a scene on the toilet with her kind of pants down. So it's, you know, what more do you want from a Julianne Moore performance?
Wasn't there another movie that also had one of those? Was it The Godard that has somebody?
I did not see The Godard, but it seems everything was in there. So
yeah, okay, fair bet. So the three you didn't see in the competition were The Godard and the Alice Rohrwacher, and what was the other one?
And the Atamagoyan, which I understand you know, really was a great
one. Was that a purposeful miss?
It was. I had some writing to do that morning, and I thought, well, I have a slot where I can catch the repeat screening if I hear great things, and the great things did not come. So,
But you did spot Scott Speedman in the wild.
I did. I spotted him at the Hunger Games party. For where else would you find him?
Well, there you go. Seems like you got the best end of that stick.
Exactly.
As it were.
But you are not a fan of the Timothy Spall performance?
I'm not. I'm sounding like such a killjoy here, especially because a lot of my favorite stuff in Cannes, I think, was outside the competition. I don't think it was a great competition lineup this year. But Mr. Turner, which I did like a lot, with kind of the exception of its lead performance. So it's kind of utterly typical that that is the award it would win. Mm-hmm. But it's a very... It's a performance that's doing something very physically specific, and I can see how kind of calculated and skilled it is, because the film around him is so kind of delicate and opalescent and watercolory almost, and then he's this very kind of big, forceful, loud physical performance in the center of it. And I think that contrast is quite intentional, because he's just... He kind of delivers every single line and he practically spits them and sort of grunts them on the screen. You can see the phlegm on the screen just about. Very grunty, scratchy.
I can't wait. A big biopic with phlegm on the screen.
Yeah, and you feel very close up to him a lot of the time. I've never been the hugest Timothy Spall fan. He's not the most delicate of performers. I would have liked a different take on it from, you know, maybe... I guess it could have been worse. It could have been Eddie Marsan doing it, who I'm sure would have, you know, gone to town. But
I was just going to say Eddie Marsan. That's so funny.
But yeah, I think it's a performance that a lot of people will love. I see it doing very well, but it was... my least favorite elements of that film.
Okay, I have one more film I have to hear your take on quickly before we want to hear about recommendations outside the films that are getting all the attention in the competition lineup, but Foxcatcher.
Foxcatcher, and now I can stop being a killjoy because I think Foxcatcher is really terrific. I sort of felt like such a pleb at one point because, you know, all the supposedly difficult esoteric films that other critics were creaming over were just not doing it for me. And then I was like, but Foxcatcher is really great. And would it be like, you know, you come here just to catch the one Oscar buzz film and then talk about that for the rest of the festival. But clearly Jane Campion and company agreed because Bennett Miller won a very, very deserved Best Director award. And it's not the kind of bait you might think it is. It's a very... It's more Capote than Moneyball. It's very reserved. It's very chilly. It's a very oppressive mood piece about really a toxic relationship between Steve Carell and Channing Tatum. That kind of the film it most reminded me of actually was Behind the Candelabra, which I did not see coming, and it's, you know, beautifully shot by Greg Fraser, all in these kind of, you know, more than 50 shades of gray.
Those are redundant words, beautifully shot by Greg Fraser.
Exactly, and I like to imagine, you know, Dane Campion watching that and kind of cheering him on because, you know, she gave him his break on Bright Star. And it's Bennett Miller's kind of craftiest film to date. And I was really intensely moved by it. I think it's I see it going down. It particularly went down with non-American critics, I think, because it takes on that kind of that American will to win and that kind of fixation on self-esteem and self-belief that often, you know, can cover a wealth of insecurities. And it's just beautifully performed by all three. I mean, Steve Carell, I was leery of that performance because I saw a lot of prosthetics and a lot of kind of playing against type in that way that can sometimes seem quite calculated and quite desperate, but it's a really witty and very kind of organic performance. I think he's fantastic. And Channing Tatum, who does so well when he's kind of working against his physicality and kind of showing the kind of insecurity behind the beefcake. And him.
Behind the Beefcake is a perfect title for this movie. if we sum up all your comments here.
Yeah, it's a better title than Foxcatcher, isn't it?
I was curious about Mark Ruffalo because my current feeling, he is one of my favorite actors, but lately I've not felt very warmly about his performances. Like, they seem to be a little overstated lately, so I'm...
understated. Okay. I think it's him in his kind of best register.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I think if you're a Mark Ruffalo fan... I would expect you to like this work.
Okay, yeah, because I had his last two I'm having trouble with a little bit. The Normal Heart, like, I just think he pushes some elements of it way too far, and he's really good in some scenes, but, you know, way too much in others, and I really thought he was bad, like, straight up bad in the Sundance movie that got a lot of buzz for a moment. So I've just been a little, you know, worried that he's, you know, coarsening or something, but I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah. His is the most supportive performance in the sense, not supporting, I think the three leads, though no doubt the campaigners of Sony Pictures Classics will disagree, but it's the one that most works in collaboration, particularly with Channing Tatum. I think they've got a great kind of such an authentic brotherly relationship, and I'm such a sucker for brother movies. I think it's, they just kind of tore me apart. It's beautiful.
So you're telling us that we're not going to have a three-way best actor campaign like a Mutiny on the Bounty situation or something? You're shocking me, Guy.
And I think we may just have seen very atypically a potential for rare category fraud, yeah.
Okay, so there's two movies that I've been reading about that sound really exciting, so I'm hoping you've seen them and can tell us whether or not we should be excited. The Tribe and White God.
I can answer 50% of your query because I'm as annoyed as anyone that I missed The Tribe. I was such a slave to my specific assignments from Variety and Hitfix that I just couldn't work it into my schedule. But I've heard nothing but good things. It seemed to be the kind of clear breakout sensation from the, you know, from the sidebars at the other end of the Croisette. But White God, I am very, very high on. I think it won the Uncertain Regard section very deservedly, I think. It turned out to be a bit of a word of mouth hit about the festival. I was at the very first screening because I was reviewing for Variety. And it went down quite a storm there. But then the repeat screening unusually was only a few days later. So it got a bit of a sort of delayed reaction. And by the time it's also kind of interesting that it's a really abrasive film. So people either go for it or they don't. And it's kind of an absurd premise about, you know, it seems like Lassie come home at first, you know, a girl separated from her dog, who her dad forces her to abandon by the side of the road because they can't afford the license. Mm-hmm. And what starts out as an incredible journey becomes this kind of canine political uprising against, you know, against the human race. And I think it's best not to say much more than that, but it goes for it big time.
I keep hearing Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. Is that just a surface level cosmetic thing?
It's a reasonable comparison. I think I mentioned it myself. It surface level in terms of it seems like that it's a plot comparison, not a tonal or a stylistic.
Okay. Okay.
It's much more kind of Grand Guignol than that.
Mm.
And it initially seems like a family film, and then it goes kind of viscerally violent and terrifying.
Is there phlegm on a lens?
There is drool on the lens. Big gobs of slobbery drool on the lens. But it's, I think, the most extraordinary feat of animal wrangling I have ever seen on screen. It's a cast of 250 dogs.
Wow.
No CGI, I'm told. They were all kind of adopted from the street or whatever by the animal trainer, and they kind of work together as this choreographed pack, and then the lead dog, which won naturally the Palm Dog Award that our friend Joe Reed is so fond of. It's a genuine how the hell did they do that kind of. I loved it, and I thought it was a very deserving winner.
And did that one get picked up? Do you know?
I don't think it has been yet. It represents a bit of a challenge because it's hard to determine the audience at first, because what first seems like a kind of family film then very emphatically is not. But I think it's the Uncertain Regard Prize will certainly help, the way it kind of helped Dogtooth and The Missing Picture last year.
Okay.
But it's a prize that can make a sort of difference to difficult movies, but I still don't see it. You know, it's not one that Sony Pictures Classics necessarily is going to pick up anytime soon.
Well, maybe Hungary will submit it for their yes. Oscar submission.
Yeah, and it's of course Cornel Mundruszko, who you know has a kind of reputation, but I'm not sure if his films have ever been picked up before in the US. I don't think they've ever come to the UK.
Delta came out like 3.5 years after it premiered at Cannes, and only barely.
Mm.
Yeah.
So any other, before we wrap up, any other quick recommendations you have for us from the sidebars that we don't hear as much about?
Yeah, the one I just caught up with this morning after hearing nothing but good things from my colleagues, and they were quite right, was also in Uncertain Regard, and it was the Ruben Östlund film Tourist, or Force Majeure. They can't seem to decide on the title. Under either name, it's really fantastic. Kind of coldly funny sort of family dissection, really, about this sort of middle-class Swedish family who go on a skiing vacation and then face a kind of weird near-tragedy and avalanche, and basically the dad's reaction to that sets the whole kind of family off course for the rest of the trip, and it's sort of in that way that Ruben Östlund kind of picks apart kind of long distance conflict in weirdly intangible and yet strangely specific ways. It's a real knockout, and it's so kind of beautifully formally composed. It's like White God, it's a film that really should have been in the competition, especially given both directors have a reputation.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of wasting slots on Michelle Hazanavicius or Acemoglu, whatever the case may be.
Sometimes it feels like they don't actually watch the movies. They just, in order to select their competition lineup, they just like, oh yeah, this director, that's fine.
Yeah, it's disappointing, and it's kind of complacent in a way that, other festivals aren't. Venice will, they will put the batshit 3-hour, 600 scene film about police officers and domestic abuse in competition, and audiences will be miserable, but it's a risk, and sometimes they pay off and sometimes they don't, but at least they kind of go for it. Whereas I think Cannes this year particularly, just so many kind of middling works by kind of brand name directors that had no real business being there.
Mm-hmm.
Although it was also kind of exciting if somebody wasn't there that there really wasn't agreement about that. Like, it feels like a lot of times there's consensus about great cons and not so great cons, and
yeah.
It was clear that you were having an experience that was different from a lot of the other colleagues that I read, and then some people who I read who liked it even less than you did, and so that's kind of intriguing. Yeah.
That's why I never really sort of buy when people say, oh, wasn't this an exceptional can, or this is such a weak can. It's like, unless you see everything, and who does? I don't think there's any way of telling, because it entirely, you know, in a festival with kind of five different sections, it depends on what kind of path you cut through them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If I had my way, I would probably focus less on the competition and more on... I hear Director's Fortnight was very strong this year, but I only got to see a couple of things from it. But that's kind of what makes it fun and what makes it interesting, because it's a bit like a game. It's kind of choose your own adventure.
Mm-hmm. You know, I somehow, in all the excitement yesterday, I somehow missed what won the Camera d'Or.
Oh, it's called Party Girl.
Yeah.
Oh, which, okay.
A very tepidly received choice. I mean, I think everyone thought it would be The Tribe. What I hear is that Nicole Garcia, the president of the Camera d'Or jury, basically said, over my dead body, are we giving it to the Ukrainian film? Because she hated it so much.
Oh, okay.
Playing her face, everything. I think Party Girl was kind of the next best compromise. Because it wasn't a festival of many kind of breakout debut films. I mean, they could have given it to Ryan Gosling just for the pretty. But...
Right, or the Whiplash.
It could have been, yeah. I was rooting for Gosling just to... I wanted Channing Tatum to win Best Actor, and Kristen Stewart to win Best Actress, and Ryan Gosling to win the Camera d'Or, and for the internet to just explode. I think it would have...
Yeah. And then you would have come in for so much wrath of all the people who are like, you really want to talk about Foxcatcher instead of these art films?
By the way, I have to say that I'm not being facetious about Kristen Stewart, who is fantastic in Clouds of Sils Maria, and I never thought I would say this, but better than Juliette Binoche. So, you know, wow. Good on her.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised to hear that she won good reviews for it, because it is like a good director, and good directors tend to up the game of their actors. But I find it a little annoying on the internet every year, where anybody who is not in prestige work regularly, everybody's so surprised all the time when they're good. I'm like, Channing Tatum is a good actor. Why are people just now admitting it?
Oh, yeah, I mean, I can't stand it when people say, what a revelation from Channing Tatum. I'm like, did you see Magic Mike? Did you see 21 John Street? You know, did you see A Guide to Recognizing Your Saints? He's, you know, he's always been, you know, promising. It's just because he's in the kind of film they actually... People sometimes can't kind of separate performance from films. They just kind of paint them in the same colors. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, in the case of Kristen Stewart, who's been good in a lot of stuff for ages, but... You know, people somehow think that all her films have been Twilight.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Carell, same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, people forget how amazing he was in Dan in Real Life.
Why are you against me?
All right, any last words before we wrap up our can coverage?
I'm not really good with even first words at the moment. I think I need a lot of winter sleep.
Right? That could be about Expendables 3 if you want.
Sylvester Stallone did wear a purple suit. Did he not to the premiere?
Did he not?
Did he? That's the thing. I think when you're not at Cannes, you know more about what happened on the red carpet than when you're there, because we just... The red carpet is the thing you basically give a mile-wide berth to, because it's otherwise so hard to sort of get through the crowds to your next screen. It sounds entirely plausible to me.
Okay, and on a scale of 1 to 11, Guy, how upset were you that you had to miss X-Men Days of Future Past to be at the Cannes Film Festival?
11 for most upset?
Yes.
I don't want to be unkind, so let's say 2.5. I mean, it's got Michael Fassbender and James McAvoy in it, doesn't it? I'm not even keeping up. I wasn't aware. I'd forgotten there was a new X-Men movie until it sort of popped up on Twitter. I was like,
were you able to see Godzilla before you left for Cannes?
I did not. I missed the chance to see Godzilla, and I went to see Grace of Monaco instead the week before, which, you know, was obviously the right call.
You might be surprised to know how rigorously we compared those films in our previous podcast. I'm not kidding.
No, he's not. It was an actual comparison.
Do they both have Derek Jacobi with a parrot on his shoulder?
If only.
All right, well, thanks for tuning in all the way from France, Sky.
Oh,
we appreciate it. And have safe travels back to the UK.
I will.
That does it for the Can wrap-up edition of the podcast with our special guest, Guy Lodge, as well as Nick Davis from Nick's Flick Picks. And we'll be back next week to talk current movies and maybe an old one or two, as we do